too bashful and modest to enforce his matrimonial rights and privileges, and that by means of Tesvino chiefly, the race is kept alive and increasing. Translation? Tarahumara men couldn't even muster the nerve to get romantic with their own wives if they didn't drown their bashfulness in home brew. Only later did I find out that I'd thrown my own wrench into the social wheels with big blunder number two, quizzing him like a cop. Arnulfo wasn't being rude with his silence. I was being creepy with my questions. To the Tarahumara, asking direct questions is a show of force, a demand for a possession inside their head. They certainly wouldn't abruptly open up and spill their secrets to a stranger. Strangers were the reason the Tarahumara were hidden down here in the first place. The last time the Tarahumara had been open to the outside world had put them in chains and mounted their severed heads on 9-foot poles. Spanish silver hunters had staked their claim to Tarahumara land and Tarahumara labor by decapitating their tribal leaders. Rarámuri men were rounded up like wild broncos and impressed into slave labor in the mines, one chronicler wrote. Anyone who resisted was turned into a human horror show. Before dying, the captured Tarahumara were tortured for information. That was all the surviving Tarahumara needed to know about what happens when curious strangers come calling. The Tarahumara's relationship with the rest of the planet only got worse after that. Wild West bounty hunters were paid $100 apiece for Apache scalps, but it didn't take long for them to come up with a vicious way to maximize the reward while eliminating the risk. Rather than tangling with warriors who'd fight back, they simply massacred the peaceful Tarahumara and cashed in on their look-alike hair. Good guys were even deadlier than the villains. Jesuit missionaries showed up with Bibles in their hands and influenza in their lungs, promising eternal life but spreading instant death. The Tarahumara had no antibodies to combat the disease, so Spanish flu spread like wildfire, wiping out entire villages in days. A Tarahumara hunter would leave his family for a week in search of game and come home to find nothing but corpses and flies. No wonder the Tarahumara's mistrust of strangers had lasted 400 years and led them here, to a last refuge at the bottom of the earth. It also led to a meat cleaver of a vocabulary when it comes to describing people. In the Tarahumara tongue, humans come in only two forms. There are Rarámuri, who run from trouble, and Chabochis, who cause it. It's a harsh view of the world, but with six bodies a week tumbling into their canyons, it's hard to say they're wrong. As far as Arnulfo was concerned, he'd met his social obligation with the limes. He'd made sure the travelers were rested and refreshed. Then he withdrew into himself, the way his people withdrew into the canyons. I could sit there all day and pursue him with all the questions I could think of, but I wasn't going to find him. Chapter 5. Yes, you'd have to be down here a long time before they'd feel comfortable with you, I was told later that night by Angel Nava López, who ran the Tarahumara schoolhouse in Muñarachi, a few miles downriver from the Quimares' hut. Años y años. Years and years. Like Caballo Blanco. Wait, I interrupted. Who? The white horse, Angel explained, was a tall, thin, chalky white man who jabbered his own strange language and would emerge from the hills with no warning, just materializing on the trail and loping on into the settlement. He first appeared 10 years before, shortly after lunch on a hot Sunday afternoon. The Tarahumara don't have a written language, let alone written records of weird hominid sightings, but Angel was dead certain about the day, year, and strangeness of the encounter because he's the one who did the encountering. Angel had been outside at the time, scanning the canyon walls to keep an eye on kids returning to school. His students slept over during the week, then scattered on Friday, climbing high into the mountains to their families' homes. On Sunday, they came traipsing back to school again. Angel liked to do a head count as they trekked in, which is why he happened to be out in the hot noon sun when two boys came tearing down the mountainside. The boys hit the river at full speed, churning through as though they were being chased by demons. Which, they gasped to Angel when they made it to the schoolhouse, they probably were. They'd been out herding goats on the mountain, they said, when a weird creature darted through the trees above them. The creature had the shape of a man, but was taller than any human they'd ever seen. It was deathly pale and bony as a corpse, and had shocks of flame-colored hair jutting out of its skull. It was also naked. For a giant, nude cadaver, the creature was pretty quick on its feet. It vanished into the brush before the boys could get more than a glimpse. Not that they hung around for more glimpsing. The two boys hightailed it back to the village, wondering who or what they'd just seen. After they reached Angel, though, they began to calm down and catch their breath, and they realized who it was. "That's the first Chuwi I ever saw," one of the boys said. "A ghost?" Angel said. "What makes you think it was a ghost?" By this point, several Raramuri elders had ambled up to see what was going on. The boys repeated their story, describing the creature's skeletal appearance, its wild shocks of hair, the way it ran along the trail above them. The elders heard the boys out, then set them straight. The canyon shadows could play tricks on anyone's mind, so it was no surprise that the boys' imaginations had run a little wild. Still, they shouldn't be allowed to panic the younger kids with wild stories. "How many legs did it have?" the elders asked. "Two." "Did it spit on you?" "No." "Well, there you had it." "That was no ghost," the elder said. "That was just an Ariwara." "A soul of the dead. Yes, that did make a lot more sense. Ghosts were evil phantoms who traveled by night and galloped around on all fours, killing sheep and spitting in people's faces. Souls of the dead, on the other hand, meant no harm and were just tidying up loose ends. Even in death, the Tarahumara are fanatics about elusiveness. After they die, their souls hustle around to retrieve any footprints or stray hair the body left behind. The Tarahumara technique for getting a trim was to pull their hair taut in the crotch of a tree and saw it off with a knife, so all those leftover hanks had to be picked up. Once the dead soul has erased all signs of its earthbound existence, it can venture on to the afterlife. "The journey takes 3 days," the elders reminded the boys. 4, if it's a woman. So naturally, the Ariwara is going to look a little bushy, what with all that chopped hair jammed back on its head. And of course it'll be moving top speed, with only a long weekend to knock out a ton of chores. Come to think of it, it was pretty impressive the boys managed to spot the Ariwara at all. Tarahumara souls usually run so fast, all you see is a swirl of dust sweeping across the countryside. Even in death, the elders reminded the boys, they're still the running people. "You're alive because your father can run down a deer. He's alive because his grandfather could outrun an Apache war pony. That's how fast we are when we're weighed down by our sapa, our fleshiness. Imagine how you'll fly once you shuck it." Angel listened, wondering if he should bother pointing out another possibility. Angel was an oddity in Muñarachi, a half-Mexican Tarahumara who had actually left the canyon for a while and gone to school in a Mexican village. He still wore traditional Tarahumara sandals and the Collera hairband, but unlike the other elders around him, Angel had on faded work pants instead of a breechcloth. He changed on the inside as well. Though he still worshipped the Tarahumara gods, he had to wonder if this wild thing in the wilderness wasn't just a Chabochi who'd wandered in from the outside world. Granted, it was probably even more of a long shot than sharing the trail with a traveling spirit. No one ever penetrated this far unless they had a very good reason. Maybe he was a fugitive hiding from the law? A mystic seeking visions? A gold digger driven mad by the heat? Angel shrugged. A lone Chabochi could be any of the above, and still not be the first of his kind to surface in Tarahumara territory. It's a natural law, or supernatural, if you're so inclined, that weird things appear where people tend to disappear. African jungles, Pacific islands, Himalayan wastelands, wherever expeditionary parties go missing, That's where lost species, Stonehenge stone idols, the flitting shadows of Yetis, and ancient, unsurrendering Japanese soldiers are sure to pop up. The Copper Canyons are no different, and in some regards, considerably worse. The Sierra Madres are the middle link of a mountain chain that stretches practically uninterrupted from Alaska to Patagonia. A desperado with a knack for backcountry navigation could hold up a bank in Colorado and slink to safety in the Copper Canyons, darting across desolate passes and desert ranges without coming within 10 miles of the next human being. As the best open-air safe house on the continent, consequently, the Copper Canyons not only spawn bizarre beings, but also attract them. Over the past 100 years, the canyons have played host to just about every stripe of North American misfit: bandits, mystics, murderers, man-eating jaguars, Comanche warriors, Apache marauders, paranoid prospectors, and Pancho Villa's rebels have all shaken pursuit by slipping into the Barrancas. Geronimo used to skedaddle into the Copper Canyons when he was on the run from the U.S. Cavalry. So did his protege, the Apache Kid, who moved like a ghost in the desert, as one chronicler put it. He followed no pattern. No one knew where he would show up next. It was unnerving to work cattle or mine a claim when every shadow, every slight noise, could be the Apache Kid closing in for the kill. One worried settler said it best. Usually, by the time you saw the Apache Kid, it was entirely too late. Pursuing them into the maze meant running the risk of never finding a way back out again. To look at this country is grand. To travel in it is hell, a U.S. cavalry captain named John Bourke wrote after barely surviving another unsuccessful pursuit of Geronimo into the Copper Canyons. The click of a tumbling pebble would echo around crazily, getting louder and louder rather than fainter, the sound bouncing from right to left to overhead. The rasp of two juniper branches would have an entire company of cavalrymen yanking out their pistols, their own shadows contorting monstrously against the stone walls as they searched wildly in all directions. More than just echoes and jumpy imaginations made the Copper Canyons seem haunted. One torment could transform into another so quickly, it was hard not to believe the Barrancas were guarded by some wrathful spirit with a sadistic sense of humor. After days of baking under a merciless sun, soldiers would welcome the relief of a few dark clouds. Within minutes, they'd be trapped in a surge of floodwater as powerful as a fire hose, scrambling desperately to escape up the slippery rock walls. That's exactly how another Apache rebel named Masai once wiped out an entire cavalry squad: by bringing them into a shallow gorge just in time to be swept away by a mountain cloudburst. The Barrancas were so treacherous, even a quick sip of fresh water could kill you. The Apache chief Victorio used to lead U.S. cavalry troops on a cat-and-mouse chase deep into the canyons, then lie in wait by the only waterhole. The cavalrymen must have known he'd be there, but couldn't help themselves. Lost and crazed by the heat, they would rather risk a quick bullet in the head than a slow choking from a thirst-thickened tongue. Not even the two toughest hombres in U.S. military history were any match for the Barrancas. When Pancho Villa's forces attacked a town in New Mexico in 1916, President Woodrow Wilson personally directed both Black Jack Pershing and George Patton to haul him out of his Copper Canyon lair. 10 years later, the Jaguar was still on the loose. Even with the full might of the U.S. armed forces at their disposal, Patton and Pershing had to be bewildered by 10,000 miles of raw wilderness, with their only possible information source, the Tarahumara, disappearing at the sound of a sneeze. The result? Black Jack and Old Blood and Guts could whip the Germans in two world wars, but surrendered to the Copper Canyons. Over time, the Mexican federales learned to take a more be-careful-what-you-wish-for strategy. What was hell for pursuers, they realized, couldn't be a whole lot nicer for the pursued. Whatever happened to the fugitives in there? Starvation, jaguar attack, dementia, a life sentence of voluntary solitary confinement was probably more ghastly than anything the Mexican court system would have meted out. So, often as not, the the Federales would rein in their horses and allow any bandit who reached the canyons to try his luck in the prison of his own making. Many adventurers who slunk in never slunk back out again, giving the canyons their reputation as the Bermuda Triangle of the borderlands. The Apache Kid and Masai galloped over Skeleton Pass into the Copper Canyons one last time and were never seen again. Ambrose Bierce, the celebrity newspaper columnist and author of the satiric hit The Devil's Dictionary, was reportedly en route to a rendezvous with Pancho Villa in 1914 when he strayed into the Copper Canyon's gravitational pull and was never seen again. Imagine Anderson Cooper vanishing on assignment for CNN, and you get the sense of the search that was launched for Bierce. But no trace was ever found. Did the lost souls of the canyon suffer a terrible fate, or wreak terrible fates on each other? No one knows. In the old days, they'd be killed off by mountain lions, scorpions, coral snakes, thirst, cold, hunger, or canyon fever, and you could now add a sniper's bullet to that list. Ever since the drug cartels had moved into the Copper Canyons, they'd guarded their crops through telescopic scopes powerful enough to see a leaf quiver from miles away. Which made Angel wonder if he'd ever see the creature at all. A lot of things could kill him out there, and probably would. If the creature didn't know enough to keep his distance from the marijuana fields, he wouldn't even hear the shot that took off his head. Hola, amigos! The mystery of the lone wanderer was solved even sooner than Angel had expected. He was still squinting into the sun, watching out for returning school kids, when he heard an echoing yodel and spotted a naked guy waving and running down the trail toward the river. On closer inspection, the creature wasn't entirely naked. He wasn't exactly dressed either. Certainly not by Tarahumara standards. For a people who prefer not to be seen, the Tarahumara always look fantastic. The men wear bright blouses over a long white cloth bound around the groin and left hanging, skirt-like, in the front and rear. They cinch it all together with a rainbow-colored sash and accessorize with a matching headband. Tarahumara women are even more magnificent, wearing brilliantly colored skirts and matching blouses, their lovely umber skin highlighted by coral-colored stone necklaces and bracelets. No matter what kind of fancy hiking duds you've got on, you're guaranteed to feel underdressed among the Tarahumara. Even by sun-crazed prospector standards, the creature was seriously shabby. He only had on some dirt-colored chabochi shorts, a pair of sandals, and an old baseball cap. That was it. No backpack, no shirt, and apparently no food, because as soon as he reached Angel, he asked in awkward Spanish for agua and made shoveling gestures toward his mouth. Maybe he could have something to eat? Asag, Angel told him in Tarahumara, gesturing for him to sit. Someone produced a cup of pinole, the Tarahumara corn gruel. The stranger slurped it down hungrily. Between gulps, he tried to communicate. He pumped his arms and let his tongue loll like a panting dog. Corriendo? The teacher asked. You've been running? The creature nodded. Todo día, he said in pidgin Spanish. All day. ¿Por qué? Angel asked. ¿Y a dónde? Why and where to? The creature launched into a long tale, which Angel found highly entertaining as performance art, but barely intelligible as narrative. From what Angel could make out, the lone wanderer was either totally nuts or not so lone after all. He claimed to have an even more mysterious sidekick, some kind of Apache warrior he called Ramon Chingon, Ray the Mean Motherfucker. ¿Y tú? Angel asked. What's your name? Caballo Blanco, he said. The White Horse. Pues bueno, the teacher said, shrugging. Good enough. The White Horse didn't linger. Once he'd gulped some water and a second cup of pinole, he waved goodbye and went trotting back up the trail. He stomped and shrieked like a wild stallion as he went, amusing the kids, who laughed and chased at his heels until he disappeared once again back into the wild.
Caballo Blanco es muy amable, Angel said, concluding his story. pero un poco raro. The white horse is a good guy, in other words, if you like him a little loony.
So you think he's still out there? I asked.
Hombre, claro,
Angel said. He was here yesterday. I gave him a drink with that cup. I looked around. There was no cup. The cup was there, too, Angel insisted. From what Angel had picked up over the years, Caballo lived in a hut he'd built himself somewhere across the Batopilas mountain. Whenever he turned up at Angel's school, he arrived with just the sandals on his feet, the shirt on his back, if that, and a bag of dry pinole hanging from his waist, like the tarahumara. He seemed to live off the land when he ran, depending on corima, the cornerstone of tarahumara culture. Corima sounds like karma and functions the same way, except in the here and now. It's your obligation to share whatever you can spare, instantly and with no expectations. Once the gift leaves your hand, it was never yours to begin with. The tarahumara have no monetary system, so corima is how they do business. Their economy is based on trading favors and the occasional cauldron of corn beer. The white horse looked and dressed and sounded nothing like the tarahumara, but in a deeper way, he was one of them. Angel had heard of tarahumara runners who used the horse's hut as a way station during long journeys through the canyons. The horse, in return, was always welcome to a meal and a place to rest when he came roaming through Angel's village on his rambling runs. Angel waved his arm, a brusque sweep of his arm out that-a-way, beyond the river and the canyon top, toward non-tarahumara country whence no good can come. There's a village called Mesa de la Yerba Buena, he said. Do you know it, Salvador?
Mm-hmm,
Salvador murmured. Do you know what happened to it?
Mm-hmm,
Salvador replied, his inflection conveying, hell yeah. Many of the best runners were from Yerba Buena, Angel said. They had a very good trail which would let them cover a lot of distance in a day, much farther than you could get to from here. Unfortunately, the trail was so good that the Mexican government eventually decided to slick it with asphalt and turn it into a road. Trucks began showing up in Yerba Buena, and in them, foods the tarahumara had rarely eaten: soda, chocolate, rice, sugar, butter, flour. The people of Yerba Buena developed a taste for starch and treats, but they needed money to buy them. So instead of working their own fields, they began hitching rides to Guachochi, where they worked as dishwashers and day laborers, or selling junk crafts at the train station in Divisadero. That was 20 years ago, Angel said. Now there are no runners in Yerba Buena. The Yerba Buena story really scares Angel, because now there's talk that the government has found a way to run a road along the canyon floor and right into this settlement. Why they would put a road in here, Angel doesn't have a clue. The tarahumara don't want it, and they're the only ones who live here. Only drug lords and illegal loggers benefit from Copper Canyon roads, which makes the Mexican government's obsession with backcountry road building rather bewildering. Or, considering how many soldiers and politicians are linked to the drug trade, rather not. That's exactly what Lumholtz was afraid would happen, I thought to myself. A century ago, the far-seeing explorer was already warning that the tarahumara were in danger of disappearing. Future generations will not find any other record of the tarahumares than what scientists of the present age can elicit from the lips of the people and from the study of their implements and customs, he predicted. They stand out today as an interesting relic of a time long gone by, as a representative of one of the most important stages in the development of the human race, as one of those wonderful primitive tribes that were the founders and makers of the history of mankind. There are rarámuri who don't respect our traditions as much as Caballo Blanco, Angel lamented. El caballo sabe. The horse gets it. I slumped against the wall of Angel's schoolhouse, my legs twitching and head pounding from exhaustion. It had been grueling enough to get this far, and now it looked like the hunt had just begun. Chapter 6. What a con job! Salvador and I set off the next morning, racing the sun to the rim of the canyon. Salvador set a brutal pace, often ignoring switchbacks and using his hands to scrabble straight up the cliff face like a convict scaling a prison wall. I did my best to keep up, despite my growing certainty that we'd just been tricked. The farther we left Angel's village behind, the more the idea nagged that the weird white horse story was a last line of defense against outsiders who came nosing around in search of Tarahumara's secrets. Like all great cons, the story of a lone wanderer of the high Sierras teetered between perfect and implausible. The news that there was a modern world disciple of the ancient Tarahumara arts was better than I could have hoped for, which made it too good to believe. The white horse seemed more myth than man, making me think that Angel had gotten tired of my questions, dreamed up a decoy, and pointed us toward the horizon, knowing we'd be hundreds of hard miles away before we wised up. I wasn't being paranoid. It wouldn't be the first time a tall tale had been used to blow a smokescreen around the running people. Carlos Castaneda, author of the wildly popular Don Juan books of the 60s, was almost unquestionably referring to the Tarahumara when he described magical Mexican shamans with astonishing wisdom and endurance. But in an apparent twinge of compassion, Castaneda deliberately misidentified the tribe as the Yaquis. Castaneda apparently felt that, in the event that his books launched an invasion of peyote-hungry hippies, the badass Yaquis could hold their own a lot better than the gentle Tarahumara. But despite my suspicion that I'd just been Castaneda'd, one odd incident helped spur me to stay on the hunt. Angel had let us spend the night in the only room he had free, a tiny mud brick hut used as the school's infirmary. The next morning, he kindly invited us to join him for a breakfast of beans and hand-padded corn tortillas before we set off. It was a frosty morning, and as we sat outside, warming our hands around the steaming bowls, a torrent of kids came swarming past us out of the schoolhouse. Rather than having the cold kids suffer in their seats, the teacher cut them loose to warm up Tarahumara style, meaning I'd lucked into a chance to witness a rarajipari, the Tarahumara running game. Angel pulled himself to his feet and divided the kids into two teams, girls and boys together. He then produced two wooden balls, each about the size of a baseball, and flipped one to a player on each team. He held up six fingers. They'd be running six laps from the schoolhouse to the river, a total distance of about 4 miles. The two boys dropped the balls into the dust and arched one of their feet, so the ball was balanced on top of their toes. Slowly, they coiled themselves down into a crouch and...
Vayan! Go!
The balls whistled past us. Flip kicked off the boys' feet like they'd been fired out of a bazooka, and the kids went stampeding after them down the trail. The teams looked pretty evenly matched, but my pesos were on the gang led by Marcelino, a 12-year-old who looked like the human torch. His bright red shirt flowed behind him like flames, and his white skirt whipped his legs like a trail of smoke. The torch caught up with his team's ball while it was still rolling. He wedged it expertly against the front of his toes and zinged it down the trail with barely a hitch in his stride. Marcelino's running was so amazing, it was hard to take it all in at once. His feet were jitterbugging like crazy between the rocks, but everything above his legs was tranquil, almost immobile. Seeing him from the waist up, you'd think he was gliding along on skates. With his chin high and his black hair streaming off his forehead, he looked as if he'd burst straight out of the Steve Prefontaine poster on the bedroom wall of every high school track star in America. I felt as if I'd discovered the future of American running, living 500 years in the past. A kid that talented and handsome was born to have his face on a cereal box.
Sí, de acuerdo, Angel said.
Yes, I hear you. It's in his blood. His father is a great champion. Marcelino's father, Manuel Luna, could beat just about anyone at an all-night rarajipari, the grown-up's version of the game I was watching. The real rarajipari was the heart and soul of Tarahumara culture, Angel explained. Everything that made the Tarahumara unique was on display during the heat of a rarajipari. First, two villages would get together and spend the night making bets and pounding tesguino, a homemade corn beer that could blister paint. Come sunup, the village's two teams would face off with somewhere between 3 and 8 runners on each side. The runners would race back and forth over a long strip of trail, advancing their ball like soccer players on a fast break. The race could go on for 24 hours, even 48, whatever had been agreed to the night before, but the runners could never zone out or relax into an easy rhythm. With the ball ricocheting around and up to 32 fast-moving legs on all sides, the runners had to be constantly on their toes as they surged, veered, and zigzagged. We say that a Rajipari is the game of life, Angel said. You never know how hard it will be. You never know when it will end. You can't control it. You can only adjust. And, he added, no one gets through it on their own. Even a superstar like Manuel Luna couldn't win without a village behind him. Friends and family fueled the racers with cups of pinole. Come nightfall, the villagers spark up sticks of acate, sap-rich pine branches, and the runners race through the dark by torchlight. To endure a challenge like that, you had to possess all the Tarahumara virtues: strength, patience, cooperation, dedication, and persistence. Most of all, you had to love to run.
That one's going to be as good as his father, Angel said, nodding toward Marcelino. If I let him, he'd go like that all day.
Once Marcelino reached the river, he wheeled around and drilled the ball to a little 6-year-old who'd lost one sandal and was struggling with his belt. For a few glorious moments, little One Shoe was leading his team and loving it, hopping on one bare foot while grappling to keep his skirt from falling off. That's when I began to glimpse the real genius of the Rajipari. Because of gnarly trails and back-and-forth laps, the game is endlessly and instantly self-handicapping. The ball ricocheted around as if it were coming off a pinball paddle, allowing the slower kids to catch up whenever Marcelino had to root it out of a crevice. The playing field levels the playing field, so everyone is challenged and no one is left out. The boys and girls were all hurtling up and down the hilly trail, but no one really seemed to care who won. There was no arguing, no showboating, and most noticeably, no coaching. Angel and the school teacher were watching happily and with intense interest, but not yelling advice. They weren't even cheering. The kids accelerated when they felt frisky, downshifted when they didn't, and caught an occasional breather under a shady tree when they overdid it and started sucking wind. But unlike most of the other players, Marcelino never seemed to slow. He was tireless, flowing uphill as lightly as he coasted down, his legs scissoring in a surprisingly short, mincing stride that somehow still looked smooth, not choppy. He was on the tall side for a Tarahumara boy, and had the same thrill-of-the-game grin that always used to creep across Michael Jordan's face as the clock was ticking down. On his team's final lap, Marcelino fired a bank shot off a big rock to the left, calculated the ricochet, and was in position to receive his own pass, picking the ball up on the fly and covering 50 yards in a matter of seconds over a trail as rocky as a riverbed. Angel banged on an iron bar with the back of a hatchet. Game over. The kids began filing back inside the schoolhouse, the older ones carrying wood for the school's open fireplace. Few returned our greeting. Many had only heard their first words of Spanish the day they started school. Marcelino, however, stepped out of line and came over. Angel had told him what we were up to. Que vayan bien, Marcelino said. Good luck with your trip. Caballo blanco es muy noragua de mi papá. Noragua? I'd never heard the word before. What's he mean? I asked Salvador. Caballo is a legend his dad knows? Some kind of story he tells? No, Salvador said. Noragua means amigo. Caballo Blanco is good friends with your dad? I asked. Sí. Marcelino nodded before disappearing inside the schoolhouse. He's a really good guy. Okay, I thought later that afternoon. Maybe Angel would buffalo us, but I gotta trust the torch. Angel told us Caballo might be heading to the town of Creel, but we had to hurry. If we didn't catch him, there was no telling where he'd turn up next.
The horse would often vanish for months at a time. No one knew where he went or when he'd be back. Miss him, and we might not get another chance. And Angel sure hadn't lied about one thing, as I was discovering by the surprising strength in my legs. Just before we began our long climb out of the canyon, he'd handed me a dented tin cup full of something he promised would help. "You'll like this," he assured me. I peered inside. The cup was full of gooey slime that looked like rice pudding without the rice. Lots of black-flecked bubbles I was pretty sure were frog eggs in mid-hatch. If I were anywhere else, I'd think it was a gag. It looked exactly like a kid had scooped the scum out of his aquarium to see if he could trick me into tasting it. Best guess, it was some kind of fermented root mixed with river water, meaning if the taste didn't make me hurl, the bacteria would. "Great," I said, looking around for a cactus I could dump it behind. "What is it?"
"Ischiate."
That sounded familiar, and then I remembered. The indomitable Lumholtz had once staggered into a tarahumara home looking for food while he was in the middle of a grueling expedition. Looming ahead was a mountain he had to summit by nightfall. Lumholtz was exhausted and despairing. There was no way he had the strength left for the climb. I arrived late one afternoon at a cave where a woman was just making this drink, Lumholtz later wrote. I was very tired and at a loss how to climb the mountainside to my camp, some 2,000 feet above. But after having satisfied my hunger and thirst with some ischiate, he went on, I at once felt new strength, and to my own astonishment, climbed the great height without much effort. After this, I always found ischiate a friend in need, so strengthening and refreshing that I may almost claim it as a discovery. Home-brewed Red Bull. Now this I had to try. I'll save it for later, I told Angel. I poured the ischiate into a hip bottle that was half full of water I'd purified with iodine pills, then tossed in a couple of extra pills for good measure. I was dog-tired, but unlike Lumholtz, I wasn't desperate enough to risk a year-long bout of chronic diarrhea from waterborne bacteria. Months later, I'd learned that ischiate is otherwise known as chia fresca, chili chia. It's brewed up by dissolving chia seeds in water with a little sugar and a squirt of lime. In terms of nutritional content, a tablespoon of chia is like a smoothie made from salmon, spinach, and human growth hormone. As tiny as those seeds are, they're super packed with omega-3s, omega-6s, protein, calcium, iron, zinc, fiber, and antioxidants. If you had to pick just one desert island food, you couldn't do much better than chia, at least if you were interested in building muscle, lowering cholesterol, and reducing your risk of heart disease. After a few months on the chia diet, you could probably swim home. Chia was once so treasured, the Aztecs used to deliver it to their king in homage. Aztec runners used to chomp chia seeds as they went into battle. And the Hopis fueled themselves on chia during their epic runs from Arizona to the Pacific Ocean. The Mexican state of Chiapas is actually named after the seed. It used to rank right up there with corn and beans as a cash crop. Despite its liquid gold status, chia is ridiculously easy to grow. If you own a chia pet, in fact, you're only a few steps away from your own batch of devil drink. And a damn tasty devil drink at that, as I discovered once the iodine had melted enough to risk a few swigs. Even with the medicinal afterbite from the pills, the ischiate went down like fruit punch with a nice limey tang. Maybe the excitement of the hunt had something to do with it, but within minutes, I felt fantastic. Even the low-throbbing headache I'd had all morning from sleeping on a frosty dirt floor the night before had vanished. Salvador kept pushing us hard, racing daylight to the canyon rim. We almost made it, too. But when we had a good 2 hours' worth of climbing still ahead, the sun vanished, plunging the canyon into darkness so deep that all I could make out were varying shades of black. We debated rolling out our sleeping bags and camping right there for the night, but we'd run out of food and water over an hour earlier, and the temperature was dropping below freezing. If we could just feel our way up another mile, we might catch enough light above the rim to make it out. We decided to go for it. I hated the idea of shivering all night on a sliver of trail on the edge of a cliff. It was so dark, I could only follow Salvador by the crunch of his boots. How he was finding the turns on those steep switchbacks without straying over the edge, I didn't really want to know. But he'd proven me wrong with his psychic navigation when he was driving us through the woods, so I owed it to him to shut up, pay careful attention to his every move, and... Wait. What happened to the crunching? Salvador? Nothing. Shit. Salvador?
No pases por aquí,
he called from somewhere ahead of me. Don't go this way. What's the problem?
Calla!
Shut up. I callad and stood in the dark, wondering what the hell was wrong. Minutes passed. Not a sound from Salvador. He'll be back, I told myself. He would have screamed if he had fallen. You'd have heard something. A crash. Something. But damn, he's taking a long...
Bueno!
A shout came from somewhere above me and off to the right.
Good here, but go slow.
I twisted toward the sound of his voice and slowly inched along. To my left, I felt the ground drop abruptly away. How close Salvador had come to stepping into empty air, I didn't want to know. By 10 that night, we'd made it to the rim of the cliff and crawled into our bags, chilled to the bone and just as weary. The next morning, we were up before the sun and fast hiking back to the truck. By the time dawn broke, we were already well on the bouncing, meandering word-of-mouth trail of the White Horse. Every time we came to a farm or tiny village, we hit the brakes and asked if anyone knew Caballo Blanco. Everywhere, in the village of Samachique, at the schoolhouse in Huisichi, we heard the same thing.
Sí, of course. He passed through last week, a few days ago, yesterday. You just missed him.
We came to a little cluster of ramshackle cabins and stopped for food.
Ah, ten cuidado con ese,
the old woman behind the counter of a roadside stand said as she passed me a dust-covered bag of chips and a warm Coke with her thin, trembly hands. Be careful with that one. I heard about that caballo. He was a fighter who went loco. A man died, and he went loco. He can kill you with his hands. And, she added in case I'd forgotten, he's loco. The last place he'd been spotted was the old mining town of Creel, where a woman in a taco stand told us she'd seen him that very morning, walking the train tracks toward the edge of town. We followed the tracks to the end of the line, asking all the way until we reached the final building, the Casa Perez Hotel, where, I was both thrilled and nervous to hear, he was supposed to be at that moment. Maybe it was a good thing I fell asleep on the corner sofa. That way, at least, I was hidden in the shadows and managed to get a good look at the lone wanderer before he saw me and bolted right back into the wild. Chapter 7. Luckily, I was closer to the door.
Hey, do you know Angel?
I stammered as I stepped between Caballo and his only way out. The teacher at the Tarahumara school? And Isidro in Huisichi? And, Luna? Miguel Luna? I kept shotgunning names, hoping he'd hear one he recognized before body slamming me against the wall and escaping into the hills behind the hotel.
No, Manuel. Not Miguel Luna. Manuel. His son said you guys were friends. Marcelino? You know Marcelino?
But the more I talked, the more his scowl deepened until it looked downright menacing. I snapped my mouth shut. I'd learned my lesson after the debacle at the Kimare compound. Maybe he'd cool out if I kept quiet and gave him a chance to size me up on his own. I stood silently while he squinted, suspicious and scornful, from under the brim of his straw campesino's hat.
Yeah, he grunted. Manuel is an amigo. Who the hell are you?
Since I didn't really know what was making him skittish, I started with who I wasn't. I wasn't a cop or a DEA agent, I told him. I was just a writer and busted-up runner who wanted to learn the secrets of the Tarahumara. If he was a fugitive, that was his own business. If anything, it boosted his credibility. Anyone who could dodge the law for all these years with no getaway vehicle except his own two legs had sure made his bones as a wannabe rarámuri. I could set aside my obligations to justice long enough to hear what had to be the escape tale of a lifetime. Caballo's scowl didn't fade, but he didn't try to get around me, either. Only later would I discover that I'd gotten extraordinarily lucky and stumbled across him at a strange time in his very strange life. In his own way, Caballo Blanco was looking for me, too.
"Okay, man," he said, "but I've got to get some beans."
He led me out of the hotel and down a dusty alley to a small, unmarked door. We stepped over a little boy playing with a kitten on the doorstep and right into a tiny living room. An old woman looked up from an ancient gas stove in an adjoining alcove where she was stirring a fragrant pot of frijoles.
"Hola, Caballo," she called.
"Cómo está, mamá?"
Caballo Blanco called back. We took seats at a rickety wooden table in the living room. "He's got mamás all over the canyons," he said. "Little old ladies who'd fill him up on beans and tortillas for only a few centavos during his rambling vagabond runs." Despite mamá's nonchalance, I could see why the Tarahumara were spooked when Caballo first came whisking through their woods. Fantastic feats of endurance under an unforgiving sun have left Caballo a little on the savage side. He's well over 6 feet tall, with naturally fair skin that has weathered into shades ranging from pink on his nose to walnut on his neck. He's so long-limbed and lean-muscled, he looks like the endoskeleton of a bulkier beast. Melt the Terminator in a cauldron of acid, and Caballo Blanco is what comes out. The desert glare had scrunched his eyes into a permanent squint, leaving his face capable of only two expressions, skepticism or amusement. No matter what I said for the rest of the night, I could never tell if he thought I was hilarious or full of shit. When Caballo turns his attention on you, he locks in hard. He listens as attentively as a hunter tracking game, seeming to get as much from the warbles of your voice as from the meaning of your words. Oddly, though, he still has an abominable ear for accents. After more than a decade in Mexico, his Spanish clanged so badly, it sounded as if he were sounding it out from phonics cards.
"What freaked me out about you," Caballo began, but suddenly stopped, bug-eyed with hunger, as Mama plopped big bowls in front of us and futzed over them with chopped cilantro and jalapenos and squirts of lime. The snarling look he'd given me back at the hotel wasn't because I was standing between him and freedom. It was because I was standing between him and food. Caballo had set out that morning for a short hike to a natural thermal pool in the woods, but once he spotted a faint trail through the trees he'd never seen before, hike and hot tub were history. He took off running and was still going hours later. He hit a mountain, but instead of turning back, he bent himself into a 3,000-foot ascent, the equivalent of climbing to the top of the Empire State Building twice. Eventually, he linked onto a path back into Creel, turning what should have been a relaxing soak into a grueling trail marathon. By the time I shanghaied him in the hotel, he hadn't eaten since sunup and was nearly delirious with hunger. "I'm always getting lost and having to vertical climb, water bottle between my teeth, buzzards circling overhead," he said. "It's a beautiful thing." One of the first and most important lessons he learned from the Tarahumara was the ability to break into a run any time, the way a wolf would if it suddenly sniffed a hare. To Caballo, running has become as much of a first option in transportation as driving is to suburbanites. Everywhere he goes at a lope, setting off as lightly equipped as a Neolithic hunter and with just as little concern about where or how far away he'll end up. "Look," he said, pointing to his ancient hiking shorts and dumpster-ready pair of Teva sandals. "That's all I wear, and I'm always wearing them." He paused to shovel steaming mounds of spicy beans into his mouth, washing them down with long, thirsty pulls on a bottle of Tecate. Caballo polished off one bowl and was refilled by Mama so quickly that he barely slowed his spoon, moving his hand from bowl to mouth to beer bottle with such ergonomic efficiency that dinner seemed less like the end of his long workout and more like its next phase. Listening to him from across the table was like listening to gas pumping into the tank of a car. Scoop, chomp, chomp, gurgle, gurgle,
scoop, chomp, chomp, gurgle. Every once in a while, he'd lift his head and deliver a brief torrent of storytelling, then dip back down to his bowl.
Yeah, I used to be a fighter, man. Ranked 5th in the world.
Back to the spoonwork.
What freaked me out was you just came blaring at me out of nowhere. We've had kidnappings and murders down here. Drug nastiness. Guy I know was kidnapped. Wife paid a big ransom, then they killed him anyway. Nasty stuff. Good thing I got nothing. I'm just a gringo indio, man, running humbly with the Rarámuri.
Sorry, I began, but his face was already back in the beans. I didn't want to bug Caballo with questions just yet, even though listening to him was like watching an art house film in fast forward. Traumas, jokes, fantasies, flashbacks, grudges, guilt over grudges, tantalizing fragments of ancient wisdom. They all came calliopeing past in a blur too quick and disjointed to catch. He'd tell a story, move on to the next, skip ahead to the third, go back and correct a detail in the first, gripe about the guy in the second, then apologize for griping because, man, he'd spent his life trying to control his anger, and that was another story altogether. His name was Micah True, he said, and he came from Colorado. Well, California, actually. And if I really wanted to understand the Rarámuri, I should have been there when this 95-year-old man came hiking 25 miles over the mountain. Know why he could do it? Because no one ever told him he couldn't. No one ever told him he ought to be off dying somewhere in an old age home. You live up to your own expectations, man. Like when he named himself after his dog. That's where the name True really came from, his old dog. He didn't always measure up to good old True Dog, but that was another story too. I waited, scraping at the label of my beer bottle with a fingernail, wondering if he'd ever simmer down enough for me to figure out what the hell he was talking about. Gradually, Caballo's spoon work slowed and came to a stop. He drained his second bottle of Tecate and sat back, satisfied.
Guadajuco, he said with a toothy grin.
Good word to learn. That's Rarámuri for cool. I pushed a third Tecate across the table. He eyed it with that skeptical sun-scorched squint.
I don't know, man, he said. Not eating all day. I can't hold it like the Rarámuri.
But he picked it up and took a sip. Thirsty work, rambling up skyscraping mesas. He took a long chugging pull, then relaxed way back in his chair, tipping the front legs up and lacing his fingers across his lean belly. Something had just clicked inside him. I could tell before he even said another word. Maybe he needed those last 12 ounces of beer to loosen up, or maybe he just had to blow out some pent-up steam before relaxing into his story. Because when Caballo started to talk this time, he kept me spellbound. He talked deep into the night, telling an amazing story that spanned the 10 years since his disappearance from the outside world and was full of bizarre characters, amazing adventures, and furious fights. And in the end, a plan. An audacious plan. A plan, I gradually realized, that involved me. Chapter 8. To appreciate Caballo's vision, you have to go back to the early 90s when a wilderness photographer from Arizona named Rick Fisher was asking himself the obvious question. If the Tarahumara were the world's toughest runners, why weren't they ripping up the world's toughest races? Maybe it was time they met the Fisherman. Total score all around, the way Fisher saw it. Some spit-chaw towns bag a ton of TV for their oddball races. The Fisherman turns into the crocodile hunter of lost tribes, and the Tarahumara get primo PR and become media sweethearts. Okay, so the Tarahumara are the most publicity-shy people on the planet and have spent centuries fleeing any kind of relations with the public. But, well, Fisher would have to deal with that speed bump later. He already had far stickier problems to handle. Like, he didn't know jack about running and barely spoke a lick of Spanish, let alone Rarámuri.
He had no idea where to find Tarahumara runners, and no clue how he'd persuade them to follow him out of the safety of their caves and up into the lair of the bearded devils. And those were only the minor details. Assuming he did assemble an all-Tarahumara track team, how the hell was he going to get them out of the canyons without cars and into America without passports? Luckily, Fisher had some special talents going for him. Top of the list was his amazing internal GPS. Fisher was like one of those house cats who reappear at home in Wichita after getting lost on a family vacation in Alaska. His ability to sniff his way through the most bewildering canyons may be unrivaled on the planet, and it appears to be mostly raw instinct. Fisher had never seen anything deeper than a ditch before leaving the Midwest for the University of Arizona, but once there, he immediately began plunging into places better left unplunged. He was still a student when he began exploring Arizona's maze-like Mogollon Canyon Range, venturing in just after the head of Phoenix's Sierra Club was killed there in a not uncommon flash flood. Fisher, with zero experience and Boy Scout-grade gear, not only survived, but came back with breathtaking photos of an underground wonderland. Even John Krakauer, the adventure Uber expert and author of Into Thin Air, was impressed. Rick Fisher can fairly lay claim to being the world's leading authority on the Mogollon Canyons and the myriad secrets they contain, Krakauer concluded early in Fisher's career, after Fisher had led him to an utterly spellbinding slice of earth like no place I'd ever seen, a Willy Wonka world of lime-green pools and pink crystal towers and subterranean waterfalls. Which brings up Rick Fisher's other skill set. When it comes to grabbing a spotlight and persuading people to do things they'd rather not, Fisher could put a televangelist to shame. Well, as much as that's possible. Take this classic fish tale that Krakauer tells about a rafting trip Fisher made into the Copper Canyons in the mid-1980s. Fisher really didn't know where he was going, even though he was attempting, by Krakauer's estimation, the canyoneering equivalent of a major mountaineering expedition in the Himalaya. Yet he still managed to convince two pals, a guy and his girlfriend, to come along. Everything was going grand. Until Fisher accidentally beached the raft next to a marijuana field. Suddenly, a drug sentinel popped up with a cocked assault rifle. No problem. Fisher just whipped out a packet of news articles about himself he carries everywhere he goes. Yep, even on very wet rafts through non-English-speaking Mexican badlands. See? You don't want to mess with me. I'm a, importante, muy importante. The bewildered sentinel let them paddle on, only to have Fisher come to shore at another drug encampment. This time, it got really ugly. Fisher's little band was surrounded by a band of thugs who, being womanless in the wilderness, were drunk and dangerously lusty. One of the thugs grabbed the American woman. When her boyfriend tried to pull her back, a rifle barrel was slammed into his chest. That did it for Fisher. No fanning out his scrapbook this time. Instead, he went berserk. "You're muy malos hombres!" he screamed in an absolute spitting fury, calling the thugs naughty, naughty men in his junior high Spanish. "Muy, muy malos!" He kept screeching and raving until, as Krakauer tells it, the thugs finally silenced the shrill lunatic by shoving him aside and walking away. Fisher had just brazened his way out of a death sentence, and naturally, he made sure that the journalist Krakauer heard about it. Fisher loved the sound of his own horn, no doubt about it, and that spurred him to keep finding reasons to toot it. While most wild men in the 80s were pushing skyward, racing Reinhold Messner to scale the 14 highest peaks in the Himalayas, Rick Fisher was burrowing down to more exotic kingdoms right beneath their feet. Using notes from Captain Frederick Bailey, a British secret agent who'd stumbled across a hidden valley in Tibet in the 1930s, while reconnoitering with rebel groups in Asia, Fisher helped locate the fabled Kintuck Falls, a thundering cascade that conceals the entrance to the deepest canyon on the planet. From there, Fisher mulled his way into lost worlds on five continents,
sliding through war zones and murderous militias to pioneer descents in Bosnia, Ethiopia, China,